Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, we pass the mic to Nikhil I. Kushalani, MD, who moderated an OncLive peer exchange on updates in the treatment of patients with resectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. Dr. Kushalani was joined by Martin F. Dietrich, MD, PhD, Jason J. Luke, MD, FACP, and Vishal A. Patel, MD, FAAD, FACMS. Dr. Kushalani is Vice Chair of the Department of Cutaneous Oncology at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. Dr. Dietrich is a medical oncologist at Florida Cancer Specialist and Research Institute and an assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. Dr. Luke is director of the Cancer Immunotherapeutics Center in the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine in Pennsylvania. Dr. Patel is an assistant professor of dermatology at the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences and the director of the Cutaneous Oncology Program at the GW Cancer Center in Washington, D.C. In this exclusive conversation, Drs. Kushalani, Dietrich, Luke, and Patel discuss the nuances of defining resectability in CSCC, the evolving treatment paradigm of resectable disease, and how to translate updated data with cemiplimab into clinical practice.
Hello, and welcome to this OncLive peer exchange titled Data Updates in the Treatment of Resectable Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma. I am Nikhil Kushalani. I'm a medical oncologist and senior member and vice chair in the Department of Cutaneous Oncology at the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. Today, it is my distinct privilege and pleasure to be joined by a panel of experts in the management of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Martin Dietrich. I'm a medical oncologist at the University of Central Florida Cancer Center in Orlando, Florida, with Florida Cancer Specialists on my clinical arm.
Hello, I'm Jason Luke. I'm a medical oncologist focused on cutaneous oncology as well as drug development for advanced cancers. I'm very excited to participate today.
I'm Vishal Patel. I'm a trained dermatologist and a Mohs surgeon, focused my time on advanced skin cancer. I'm the director of cutaneous oncology at the GW Cancer Center in Washington, D.C., where I oversee some of their skin cancer immunotherapy programs.
Thank you again to our panel members for joining us. And as you can all see, this is truly a multidisciplinary effort that we hope to imbibe and share some of our experience as well as expertise with regards to staging systems as well as risk factors or risk defining features from the tumor. How do you utilize that information in your clinical practice to define resectability? Is there some clinical pearls that you could share that you feel may not define true resectability? Or, you know, we tend to use the term locally advanced unresectable tumors quite frequently with reference to cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma and certainly basal cell carcinoma as well. So what practical tips would you suggest?
That's the difficult piece for this disease process, because I'm sure we've all had discussions in multidisciplinary tumor board or with colleagues across the country. We present one case and one surgeon will say, well, that's not resectable, but another, you'll find a surgeon who'll say that that is potentially resectable. We should note that the NCCN did change that kind of low risk, high risk dichotomous approach into now a three-tiered low risk, high risk, and very high risk factors. And some of those very high risk factors, the very large tumors, the tumors that have much more rare features, lymphovascular invasion, desmoplastic type of growth, and especially multinodal local recurrences, extracapillary extension, bound down tumors. These are going to be the very difficult surgeries that, yes, I'm sure that we can do surgery. You certainly should at least have a pause and discussion about it. In my clinical experience, I think that if you have those primary tumors that even in anatomically difficult areas, if you are able to feel that you're resecting above the bone and you're going to be able to resect and get around the whole tumor, that seems like a reasonable case to do surgery on. And I'm sure there are caveats to that. But when we start to get into the larger tumors, fixed tumors, and multi-node types of tumors, that's when it can go either way. And that's exactly when I think the medical oncologist needs to be there to provide some of the data around what another approach could be.
Well, I do want to add to that. I think that that's one of the biggest questions when we are looking at our current use of immunotherapy. I hope this paradigm is going to advance and shift into earlier lines. But resectability, as defined by margin negativity, is only really one dimension of outcomes. We're looking at functional and cosmetic concerns in patients that may be utilized. And even if they have a good surgical outcome, I do think there is still a component that is very questionable on when to introduce immunotherapy and also do a little bit of a sequence by sequence kind of evaluation. We have a very strong usage of radiation therapy for high risk disease in my area. If a relapse were to occur, we really are concerned about whether or not we can manage those relapses appropriately and have a similar impact. So what I'm getting at is that surgery, what is considered surgically resectable, has certainly been a moving target. And I think a moving target that in the interest of patients' short and long-term outcomes has been moving in the direction of multidisciplinarity. So I never mind seeing a patient in clinic early on and looking at this from a perspective of multidisciplinarity. Is there a way I can make a patient's treatment course and outcomes better? We had a patient the other day, and I know the anecdote doesn't make a rule, where a large cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma on the right index finger has been amputated. By surgical definition, this would have been a margin negative resection, but from a functional outcome, obviously a catastrophe. I think there's an inclusion of multidisciplinarity that we should do in very similar ways, like we see it in melanoma from the get-go, from stage one onward, an inclusion of all team members to ensure that a patient has the long-term in mind. I do think that immunotherapy's role is so strong in the setting of both locally advanced and regional disease that it should be discussed or at least offered for each patient, because each patient's individual outcomes expectations are so different that I think it's not necessarily a matter of sequence, but it should be a similar way like we do in melanoma or in breast or in other diseases where multidisciplinarity is much more common than cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma.
I think that's very well said, Martin. I think, you really hit the nail on the head there, saying that the patient and decision-making should be included in terms of what is right for a given patient, because their clinical presentations are so varied, their expectations from treatment differ. And while certainly immunotherapy has changed how we approach this disease in the locally advanced and metastatic and now potentially in the perioperative setting, immunotherapy by itself certainly is not trivial. Most patients tolerate it well, but there can be some long-term chronic toxicities that I think we should obviously keep in mind. While not the main crux of discussion today, definitive radiotherapy for some of these patients is very appropriate as well. In some cases who are not appropriate surgical candidates, radiotherapy can certainly salvage many of these patients, and that calls for inclusion of the radiation oncologist in this discussion. So I was going to direct another question to Dr. Patel in that same vein, being the surgeon in the group here. How much surgery is enough? Often it's hard for us to say, when should a surgeon stop operating? Because technically a lot of these tumors remain resectable, but we know that the biology will change with every subsequent recurrence. So when do you in your practice think about these CSCC patients and say, I think it is time for them to see a medical oncologist or someone with additional systemic expertise?
This is a local regional disease, and 80% of patients who will die of this really just have only local regional disease. They're not going to have the typical type of distant metastatic disease. That is a good point to highlight of what our endpoint and how we think about this progression of this disease. Also on the other spectrum, we talked about staging. The importance of the staging has really lacked in our community 5 years ago or 7 years ago, is also realizing how the low-risk tumors perform. For squamous cell carcinoma, we get into the mindset of thinking low risk and high risk, but we don't have great definitions of what that means. And sometimes we overtreat low risk, and we certainly have an epidemic of squamous cell carcinoma in this country. It's our responsibility to treat those low risk ones appropriately and maybe not over surgerize low risk ones or give patients to surgery fatigue. And certainly the cost that goes into treating all these squames, sometimes too aggressively, is not unimportant. And so to get to your question about when is surgery, when we are worried about those high-risk tumors, why do we operate on them? Is because we have good data now In the last about 18 months, there have been a number of high quality papers showing that surgical clearance with good margin control is the best predictor for good outcomes, and specifically complete margin analysis. So traditionally, many people are familiar with Mohs surgery and think of that as what we do for smaller tumors on the head and neck or to keep margins small. But I really would like to challenge that for people to realize that Mohs surgery is just a technique for a variety of cutaneous tumors. Really better to think about this as complete margin analysis. You're pathologically processing this in an in-fos pathology way. It's just a fancy way of saying that we're not doing bread loafing to just look at random samples to say that the margin is clear, but we're in fact looking at the whole peripheral and deep margin. And now the NCCN likes us to use that terminology, either peripheral deep margin analysis or PDMA, complete margin analysis, or complete and circumferential peripheral deep margin analysis. Quite a mouthful, and leave it to the NCCN for us to come up and have to use that nomenclature. But that is critical. And that's why surgeons say if they can resect the tumor and get it all out, we'd like to do that. But in the last 2 years, we've had now so much exciting data to show us that maybe we actually have something that we can utilize even earlier on to get us to those same types of outcomes. And of course, we're going to be talking about immunotherapy and moving that into a neoadjuvant type of approach. And there's so much work being done on other types of ways to improve those outcomes with either injections, oncolytics, low dose radiation, adjuvant, whatnot. And that highlights your point that I think involving the multidisciplinary team earlier on, maybe on the first pass, is so much more critical in informing our surgical friends that we want to just have a discussion about this. And I think it's now become very critical that medical oncology should be involved right at the onset for any of these higher stage patients, just so we're thinking about what happens if it fails. And so we have a plan, or maybe we should think about a different approach than just going for the big whack from the get-go.
Let's quickly move on to some of the meat of discussion within the evolving therapeutic paradigms for resectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma and sort of the role of the medical oncologist here as well. You know, everyone wants to hear, how has this changed? How has new treatment in resectable CSCC evolved over a period of time? So Dr. Luke, your thoughts on what would you say has been the most significant progress or impactful studies in this field recently?
I mean, the practice-changing phase two trials that came out now, I think 4 years ago or so, you know, really kind of changed the bar when people saw the depth of the responses and how rapid the responses were. And so I think a lot of people in their minds think immunotherapy is going to be a iterative process over many months and years. But what we saw in cutaneous squam, by contrast, was that you start seeing the lesions shrink like almost within like days or in a week. It's actually quite amazing to behold. And having that then really makes the idea of intervening quickly, you know, much more palatable in a perioperative sense, right? So, you know, I actually think it's quite amazing because the actual clinical trials that established the utility of anti-PD-1 immunotherapy across multiple drugs, they're not that big. They really just are not that big relative to what you see in other diseases. This recent gastric cancer trial was like 4,000 patients to show the benefit. Here we've gotten a phase two expansion, 30 patients or something, but it's because we see rapid shrinkage of the cancer that it's so impactful. And so I really just think it's that impact is what has informed things. And that has made, I think, where it was entirely a surgical disease, really had people start to change their mind. And when you treat just, you know, any number of these patients and you see that happen in your clinic, you know, we just don't see that in cancer therapy very often. And occasionally with targeted therapies, you'll see that kind of reduction, right? But not in this kind of scenario. So it's really that amalgamation. And now with the addition of this neoadjuvant component, you know, I really think just that has impacted so clearly doctors who are taking care of these patients to realize that you can make this difference. And I guess the final piece I'd say is then if you look on the back end of these trials, these people who are doing well, they do very well for a long time. So it's not just that initial blast that you see, but rather that, you know, sort of long, you know, tail that we sort of think about for this. That's really what has completely changed the field. I actually don't know that a specific trial, though we can name them, is necessarily the landmark per se. It's just that the amalgamation, you don't see waterfall plots like this, a duration of response like this. Even in those of us that did a lot of melanoma oncology, we didn't really see this kind of thing, right? So I really think, you know, that's what has happened. You know, I think the unmet need probably still remains that not every patient is benefiting, obviously, and an ability to escalate would be beneficial, because in certain scenarios, you're still on the fence. You're like, well, if we don't do the surgery like tomorrow, we might lose the window, right? And I think even though it's 50% response rate, maybe even a little higher, that's not always actually enough. And so I do think there's actually still an unmet need to actually even further enhance that. And that seems very promising given the data that we've seen so far.
No, absolutely. Dr. Dietrich, your thoughts?
I think the identification of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma as the most uniquely immunotherapy sensitive disease space, independent of biomarkers, is really amazing. I think cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is in itself the biomarker. And if I were to make cross-histology comparisons, it would only be measuring up against MSI high tumors in terms of response rates and duration of response. And there's also a visceral component to the massive amount of immunotherapy-mediated responses, the sometimes aggressively observed inflammatory changes surrounding tumors, with really almost like an ejection of the tumor from the tumor bed, where a clean-based ulcer is the first treatment step. By measuring by RECIST criteria, oftentimes I do think that we're underestimating the actual depth of response, tissue defects, residual scarring, and other things make oftentimes the disease response assessment more challenging. Many times, if I would feel by RECIST that persistent disease, even a significantly reduced dimension would be present, I don't necessarily identify any sort of activity. I get repeat evaluations by dermatology. We have PET scan assessments that still have anatomical persistence without actual physiological activity. So I do think there is an even bigger percentage of patients that are benefiting. Obviously, very difficult to do with those that don't. This is a smaller subset, certainly surpassing the majority of patients. And fortunately, many of these patients that come to us that are unresectable eventually become resectable in a very neat way, and sometimes only for the sake of confirming a pathological complete response that a resection or biopsy is being performed. But certainly a field that has been dramatically improving. Challenges are the patients that you've already mentioned when we're looking at patients with an intrinsic or induced immune compromised state that are more challenging to treat, transplant recipients, how to manage those. Sometimes, depending on the organ site of transplant, more difficult to evaluate if this is a non-replaceable organ site, like cardiac transplant, just makes it more challenging. Renal transplants, where we have probably the largest number of correlation, we certainly have backup options with going back to dialysis. But this is would be a great field where both the impact on reduced immunotherapy responses as well as more localized therapies might be of great interest. Obviously, we don't have any data. We extrapolate from what we've done in larger clinical trials. They're excluded, but they certainly come up quite frequently, and their behavior almost exclusively, in my experience, high risk or very high risk in nature. So a different biology in the context of immunocompromise of whatever origin. So still a lot of things that will need tailoring. And then also the question about when to utilize immunotherapy in the post-surgical setting. I have a tendency, and I believe that's a practice pattern that probably many of you share, that immunotherapy in its PD-1, PD-L1 centric universe has a need for an intact tumor microenvironment, and where the neoadjuvant or induction immunotherapy responses seem to be doing better than the actual adjuvant responses. So again, the call to include a multidisciplinary evaluation early on if a patient is deemed high risk. I do think that we're seeing tendentially better responses moving immunotherapy into a space where immune microenvironments are still intact and not surgically or by radiation approaches impaired.
There's clearly such great interest in neoadjuvant immunotherapy. It sort of spawned a multitude of clinical trials, some of which may have already been ongoing at the time the cemiplimab neoadjuvant trial was being conducted. Just simple examples, and these are all cohorts of between 20 to 40, 45 patients. University of Pittsburgh, where Dr. Luke is conducting a neoadjuvant pembrolizumab trial. Cemiplimab is being looked at, two other studies, one at Emory, one at the University of Southern California. And then even anti-PD-L1 therapies are being investigated at Stanford with atezolizumab in patients, again, with resectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. So I think all of these will clearly add to the growing body of literature that we have. And I'm sure each one of these trials has its own nuances, its own endpoints. I think what's going to be critical is for us to assimilate some of the biomarker data, if we have that available, or the biopsies that are being done, to try and sort of streamline which patients we can offer this to. I think Dr. Dietrich said it best earlier in the segment. that maybe having cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma by itself is a biomarker for consideration of anti-PD-1 therapy, both earlier in the course of the disease or even at a later point in time.
It's really exciting. It's kind of like what Dr. Luke said, is that it certainly is gratifying to be able to see what you're treating and then see it melt away. And it is remarkable that in the Neil Gross study published in the New England Journal last fall, has some really impressive pictures of tumors after 1-2 doses melting away. We had a few patients in the trial, one of which had a 14-centimeter squamous cell carcinoma wrapped around, enveloping his whole forearm almost, and after 3 doses was completely gone. And it's really quite remarkable. I show the picture all the time. That data, you know, we talk about the study as a whole, revealed that patients who received up to 4 doses of neoadjuvant cemiplimab therapy, these are all patients that were planned to have resection. Not all of them went on to have resection for a number of reasons. Some did so well that they just refused to have resection. Others were lost to follow-up. And a small safety signal that we can talk about that certainly is important to discuss. But over half of them, I believe it was 51% of them, had a pathologic complete response. And I'm talking about like that example, that patient with the 14-centimeter squam, received 14 doses, had only scar left on his forearm. I resected all of the scar and we cut 196 blocks, and not a single one of them revealed any evidence of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. So it's remarkable when they have the PATCR. And it's important to note, we're just at the beginning of this timestamp for this data. We're just looking at overall response rate. It should also add another 13% or so of patients were major pathologic responders, so 10% or less viable cells within the resection specimen. And so if we look at that intention to treat analysis, we're talking about 2/3 of people were considered a combined overall pathologic response rate. Did not include some of those patients that did so well that they refused surgery. So in my mind, that number is probably even higher, but staying true to the study, we're saying about 2/3 of patients. What will be important to note, and we take the corollary from melanoma and Merkel cell, that if we see pathologic complete responses, we have evidence in other tumors to know that this likely will result in improved overall survival, recurrence-free survivals for patients. But that still, of course, is important information that we need to get from ongoing evidence. The waterfall plots, as Dr. Luke said, are quite impressive when you see nearly 80% of them all downturned in long bar graphs.
No, absolutely. I just wanted to remind everyone that that trial was designed very intentionally. There were up to 4 doses of cemiplimab, each administered 3 weeks apart. But after 2 doses, there was a mandated formal restaging that was performed. And I think, you know, at that point, when this trial was designed, the jury was still out. Like, are we going to potentially lose that surgical window? We're taking a potentially curative option for patients and then subjecting them to up to 12 weeks of therapy. And so there were very, very clear safeguards that were built in, and only patients deemed to clinically benefit would continue for 2 more cycles and then go on to an operation. You raise a great point. Do we yet know, does a PATCR or major pathologic response translate into longer term durable disease control? Do patients who achieve that, do they even require postoperative radiotherapy when they may have met criteria previously for consideration of radiotherapy? I'll even ask a more provocative question, is there a role for surgery at all? Can we actually eliminate surgery and go down an entirely non-operative path for some patients utilizing radiotherapy? So these are, I think, important questions that the current generation of clinical trials will certainly need to address. At the end of the day, the patients benefit because we're actively seeking options that potentially could improve their quality of life as well.
I think it's important just to piggyback off what you're saying and what everybody has been saying about surgery, just as we think about where surgery falls into place for this. We use surgery as a gold standard because cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma has just not had good therapies. And so we consider that the gold standard, but maybe just by default. And I think that's important to realize that, because this study did really turn people's heads to have some much more flexibility. The future study certainly will, of saying, do we need to rush to surgery? That's going to take time for surgical colleagues to adopt and feel much more comfortable with as well. But I think it's important because I think, as Dr. Luke had said, most patients are going for surgery. We're thinking about surgery, comparing ourselves against surgery. But as Dr. Dietrich pointed out very nicely, we might want to push back of why surgery is our gold standard. And just historically, you know, because the tumors were clumped with other tumors, it just became a logical place. But I think you've really highlighted that nicely that maybe we should not be thinking about surgery as the gold standard anymore.
We do have certainly the experience that patients are walking away from surgery if their responses are amazing. See, I unfortunately see this quite often in my male patients, that when a complete response clinically is achieved, that and they're kind of lost to follow up and consider this a resolved issue. That data presented here was amazing. 50% of patients clearly do not require surgery. This is a rate that we see in neoadjuvant breast cancer, maybe neoadjuvant rectal carcinomas, where we may have to think about observation strategies where big surgeries may not be required. Another factor that I think, just to look at the study in a more contextualized setting as we're moving into our discussion about neoadjuvant immunotherapy, is that patients that had prior radiotherapy were excluded. That is a major factor. If you think about the individual radiation therapy impact and sensitivity of cells, we see the T lymphocytic population inside the tumor microenvironment by far the most radiation therapy sensitive, and therefore concerning that we're causing a localized immunodeficiency in responses by altering the immune microenvironment in this setting as well. I think for now, Dr. Patel is going to be the gold standard for treatment. I think there's going to be a lot of research needed to replace surgery in this setting, but the data is certainly promising and moving forward. And certainly if patients have deep responses and the durability of it clearly point in the direction of cure-like states in the long run. So this might certainly be not an unreasonable part. And I've had patients that have complete responses that do not want to go onto surgery for whatever reason, may it be comorbidities or personal preference. I'm not sure that I can, based on this data, push as hard as I used to with regards to saying you absolutely need this surgery. So the responses here in the neoadjuvant setting, absolutely practice-changing in my opinion.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.